It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Evers has set up a task force to identify ways for Wisconsin to deal with climate change. We'll talk with the chair of that panel and then a critic of the governor's approach on the issue. First, the presidential election is still more than a year away, and Democratic candidates have already had four televised debates. It's left candidates balancing whether to go easy on each other or try to stand out by taking swipes at their fellow Democrats. That tension came up in this exchange between Pete Buttigieg and Julian Castro during last month's debate in Houston. This followed Castro questioning the memory of former Vice President Joe Biden.
This is why presidential debates are becoming unwatchable.
Yeah. Yeah,
this reminds everybody of what they cannot stand about Washington. Scoring points against each other, poking at each other, and telling each other that, you're my plan, your plan. Look, we all
That's called a Democratic primary election.
That's
called an election. That's an election. You know, this is what we're here for. It's an election.
Our next guest says maybe it's time to try something different, and if debates don't change to reflect the current political climate, they risk becoming irrelevant. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her books include The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. She wrote a piece for The Washington Post about how we can redesign debates. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you watch these debates this year and maybe in years past, what is bugging you about them? What do you think they're getting wrong as a format?
Well, I've spent the past 2 years writing about polarization and conflict in the United States and around the world. And so when I tuned into the debates earlier this year, I had this really weird sensation. You know, I felt like I was like a space alien watching like a faraway culture trying to understand what this ritual was all about. Like, it just felt really anachronistic, like really like it hadn't kept up with the reality that we're dealing with. You know, I mean, politicians and the news media meet at debates, right? Like, that's the intersection of those two institutions, and they are both hugely distrusted by the American public at this point. And yet we're still running the debates the exact same way we did when the first one was televised in 1960. So you have these sort of self-serious moderators trolling for conflict, and the candidates have opening statements, and, you know, they're highly prepped and powdered. And it's a lost opportunity, I think, given the level of distrust and polarization in the country.
Yeah, there's this idea that, okay, candidates need to find that moment to stand out. And with social media now, that moment to go viral with that catchy line or that bold attack or that big back and forth. Is there just an incentive to go for something cheap and easy here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be fair, you know, in journalists, like all people who tell stories, appreciate conflict. I mean, conflict is an essential part of a good story. That's just how the human brain works, right? What I would say is that the kind of conflict that they are provoking in the debates is a really kind of primitive, not very interesting conflict at this point. You know, it's just the kind of like, well, you know, he said that you want Medicare for all. What do you say to that? You know, and it's like, we get that all day long, right? We get that on social media, and we get it in the sort of clickbait news that we're subjected to. So it's not that interesting anymore to keep having, you know, CNN moderators poking the candidates and the candidates poking each other and trying to get them to get upset or say something. I mean, conflict is important, but I would argue there's like a deeper level of conflict that's more interesting than this kind of like very basic kind of primitive conflict.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page what they thought about debates. Jonathan tells us anything that encourages grandstanding and zingers is just WWE style entertainment for their supporters. He's thinking along the same lines you are, I think, to an extent. But okay, how do we, let's say the moderators, the media who manage these things, how do they get something other than the grandstanding and the zingers that Jonathan is worried about?
Right. Like, it's easy to criticize, but then it's like, what are we going to do? I mean, we have to make this interesting. We got to fill this time. There's an awful lot of money and energy that goes into these things. So, you know, if we continue with the space alien metaphor, if you bear with me,
please do.
Like, if we came here from outer space and we were like, man, there's a lot of division and distrust in this society, and yet they have to elect a leader, and there are all these problems that just aren't getting solved, and like most Americans are super exhausted and burnt out on the whole thing, What would you do then? Like, if we, you know, think about it that way, like, how would you build debates from scratch if you recognize the situation that we're in and are not sort of living in denial about it? And I think the clear way, one clear way to build trust is to trust the voters, to just get really transparent and use some of, give up some of your control as the journalists and the politicians and say, you know, what do people care about most? What do voters care about? And then deliver on that. And so you see a little of that, right? Like, voters repeatedly say in polls that they care a lot about healthcare, right? And every debate has really, you know, really kind of hammered on healthcare to the almost ad nauseum, right? But you know what else they say? 70% of Democratic voters say they want a candidate who can unite the country. That's not a narrow margin. And in the states with the earliest primaries, 2/3 say they want a nominee who would work with Republicans to get things done in office. But not a single question that I've seen in any of the debates has addressed this. And it doesn't have to be like soft, boring, squishy question, right? Like, if you ask the candidates, look, this country is really historically unprecedented levels of division, and people are upset about it. What are you going to do on day one to try to get things done in that climate? You know, and do you understand the other side even as you disagree with them? Do you have people on your staff who disagree with you? You know, tell me about one of the conversations or debates you've had with them recently. Like, can you hear both sides even as you hold on to your own beliefs?
Talking to Amanda Ripley about a piece she wrote in the Washington Post about debates. She says it's time for a rethinking, a redesign, or to try something new. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do presidential debates make a difference? Do you watch them? Do you like how they're done? Or do you think we need to change them? 800-642-1234. Amanda, in your piece, you throw out an interesting idea. Maybe we need something different than a debate, bringing candidates to a group of people who aren't their natural core supporters. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was thinking, like, it might be interesting to take candidates and put them in American homes. Like, you know, literally take, you know, Elizabeth Warren and put her in a white Christian evangelical home in Tennessee, right? And she talks to the family and, again, listens and tries to understand without letting go of her own core values. And you sort of see, like, who can talk to people without talking down to them? You know, who can be curious even as they disagree? Because I think that's what's really, what people are really yearning for. Like, I don't know about you, but I don't know anyone who says, you know what I want more of? What I want more of is argument. Like, I'm just not getting enough argument on TV these days. So, you know, I think that would be more interesting, right? Is to say, look, okay, if this is a huge problem that we have, we are paralyzed by our divisions. Let's see someone try to deal with this differently. Let's see if someone, which of these candidates has the skills to make different kinds of people feel heard, even as they don't necessarily compromise on all their beliefs.
Well, I would suggest maybe there is one group that does want a particular kind of argument. Core supporters of Democrats and core supporters of Republicans want their candidates out there fighting in the mix, arguing with the other side, and they don't want that kind of compromise. They may not be the majority of the country. They probably aren't. But do you think that's part of what incentivizes, especially in the primary debate, this kind of conflict-oriented debate?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true and an important point to note. Like, they're, you know, playing to the base. That's who comes to these debates, right? That's who watches them. And I guess I just would say I think it's short-sighted and old-fashioned. Like, I don't think it's worth the damage it does to the majority of Americans to keep doing it this way just to appeal to your most kind of fervent, dogmatic believers. Because that's, you know, we're talking like 10%. Of voters. This is like the same people who are on Twitter. They are not representative of the country, of Democratic voters. And so you're really playing to an extreme end. And you're right, the incentives are there to do that. But I would argue they're being really exploited by kind of a dated and not very creative format that is imposed on the process.
We're talking to journalist Amanda Ripley about the ways our presidential debates are failing, she says, to speak to our polarized political climate, to help bridge polarization of the country. And she has ideas on how to change them, or maybe replace them, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch presidential debates? Do you like watching them? If you're a Democrat, what do you think of the way the debates have been done for this big cast of characters this time? Republicans, how about the 2016 packed field of Republicans? What did you think of those debates? Do you think something needs to change? Do you think it's too conflict-oriented, too theatrical? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Amanda Ripley about a piece she wrote in the Washington Post about debates, presidential debates, and what's wrong with them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If we asked you to design a presidential debate, what would be your priorities? And what do you want to hear from candidates in debates? How do you want to hear it? Argument, back and forth, one at a time, different settings. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the word debate inherently means debate, and I think we should just heighten the level of debate we have. Bring it at least up to a high school debating team or a college debating society. What's happening now is all we have is people getting away with a couple second sound bites, just repeating the same tagline over and over again. And I don't think I would worry about people talking down to people. I want people to talk up for a change. I want them to increase their level of sophistication and get called out when they lie as well. Let's up the level of debate instead.
Tom, thanks for the call. Amanda, what do you think?
I think that's interesting. I mean, it is true that there are ways to have debates that are more interesting than what we're seeing. It's difficult to do, but not impossible. Just to be throw out a totally wacky idea, one interesting concept that I've heard about is called a reverse debate, where, you know, the candidates do their thing, they make their points, they argue, and then you literally switch places. And the person who wins is the one who most persuasively argues the other point of view, right? So that's hard to imagine for like a million reasons. But wouldn't it be interesting to see, and in fact, that's what high school debate teams do, right? Like, you don't necessarily know which side you're going to be debating. You prepare both sides and you show up and you make the case. And that would reveal to us, like, which person actually does understand the other side, even as they disagree.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. We'll go to Madeline now in Green Bay. Madeline, hi.
Hi. I wish they would give them more time to fully explain what they're talking about. For example, they asked Elizabeth Warren, will you raise taxes to provide for health care? And her response was, I'm looking at the overall cost. Well, I wish they'd give her time to explain what that means. And, you know, raising your taxes is like a buzzword. And there's so much more involved than just, well, are you going to raise taxes? You know, you got all these paperwork with the insurance companies and there's billions of dollars goes into that.
Gotcha, Madeline. Thanks a lot for the call. Amanda allowing more time for nuanced answers, she says, though, with so many candidates in this time around, that might be harder to do.
Yeah, and I think Madeline's pointing again to the sort of, you know, predictable, boring, superficial level that these debates tend to stay on, right? And there's different ways to kind of get deeper into more interesting territory. But, you know, journalists, including myself, have not traditionally been trained in those ways. You know, I did a lot of conflict mediation for the work I'm doing now, and I learned that there are different questions you can ask to get a little deeper, to get more nuanced. Otherwise, you do just end up with these talking points back and forth, like watching a tennis match that never ends. I mean, I do think it's important to remember that 2/3 of Americans don't identify with either political extreme. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily looking for a moderate. And this is the distinction that, again, I don't think the debates have caught up with. So most Americans are open to a big change agenda, particularly on things like healthcare. But what they want first is a leader who understands them. Like, they don't actually trust politicians to solve their problems at this point. It's more like, do you even get what I'm talking about? Like Madeline was saying, like, do you even get all the paperwork and all the, like, do you get this? And that's the thing that the debates are not revealing.
What, you gave an example of a question earlier. What other kind of ways are there to ask those questions that hopefully provoke a deeper response?
You know, one thing that I think would be interesting would be to ask, you know, explain why someone might oppose gun control or abortion and still be a good person. Like, that would be a question for the Democratic candidates, right? This, again, it's uncomfortable, right? Because it goes against the grain. It goes against the incentives, as we talked about, to play to the base. But I think that's interesting conflict, right? When you make people uncomfortable to ask them a serious, meaningful question, not when you just kind of poke at them and try to provoke their anger. I think that's a question that, you know, can you think of solutions to these really hard issues so that neither side would necessarily have to compromise their core beliefs? Like, how creative are you in thinking about this? Or do you just want to win?
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Ripley about presidential debates and how to make them better. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Nakusa. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Tom?
Well, I guess I'd just kind of qualify what I'm going to say by saying that, you know, I think the American public is just probably not as interested in debates than it used to be, just given the political division between parties and within parties. I know that talking to people that I know, you know, people are just generally fed up. But, you know, I guess one idea I had is that I think the American public would actually do a better job designing debates and questions. So if you had, like, let's say, focus groups prior to the debates that would focus in on issues that matter to the American public. And then perhaps out of that could be some issues and then questions that could be recommended to the moderators. I think politicians, and you see it in debates and you see it every day, are less interested in what we want as American people than what they want. And it's time that, you know, I think the American public would have some power and control in helping to design debates.
Tom, that's really interesting. Thanks for that call. What do you think about that idea, Amanda?
I think I totally agree with Tom. I vote for Tom for president. Like, that's I totally agree because, you know, I mean, if we go back to this fundamental crisis of confidence, of faith in our institutions, right? If we know that the government and the news media are not trusted, well, one way to get people to trust you is to trust them first. So hand over the wheel, like, give, within reason, right? Give voters, give the public more control over the process. And I agree. I think there's you know, millions and millions of creative, reasonable, informed Americans who are just totally tuned out of politics right now and of the debates in particular.
Tom, thanks for the call. Karen joins us next in Galena. Karen, hello.
Hello. I agree with the woman just said, and I'm calling because I'm 75 years old. And when I was younger, the League of Women Voters hosted the debates, and they were genuine debates. We do not have debates now. They would ask serious questions and on serious issues that the country really needed to know about. And now we have these TV news anchors, and they're asking the same kind of questions and doing the same thing that they do on their news show. They're just pitting one candidate against the other candidate. Just to, you know, they want ratings, and that's what they're used to, asking them things like that. But it's not a debate. And my suggestion would to get the League of Women Voters back in and run the debate and run a real debate.
Karen, thanks a lot for that call. Amanda, go back to the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea of, like, looking to our civic institutions, which we know are, like, kind of frayed, but really important. Are there institutions, you know, the YMCA, the Rotary Clubs, you know, churches, mosques, synagogues, like, are there institutions that might help us with this in a way that maybe they used to many years ago? I mean, I think if you can find ways to get trusted institutions back into the process, as well as regular voters, then you're going to go a long way to restoring the American public's faith in the process. But also, it's just going to make it more interesting. Like, I just, my number one criticism is that this is just not interesting or helpful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us next in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think no matter how you structure the debates, I think the whole process is so long that people are fatigued, as has been mentioned. It's been we'll have nearly 2 years of an election cycle running, and it just promotes more and more division when the same people that are out debating one another and trying to score points go back to Washington and try to govern by doing the same thing. We have elections that last probably an immense amount of time, more than any of the other civilized democracy.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. That brings up a whole another issue, Amanda. But do you think that's part of it, the fatigue and attrition that comes along with our, by world standards, really long election process?
I mean, I think that's a really good point. Like, there's a much bigger problem here, which is that, you know, people feel like our system is rigged, and it is. I mean, we have handed over too much of our election process to big moneyed interests. And all Americans, I think most Americans know that, understand that, feel that viscerally. And one of the outcomes of that is the length and the spectacle and the just sort of soul-crushing tenor, relentless tone of the campaigns. And it's true that, you know, I talked to some journalists from other countries when I was working on this piece, and I was like, you know, what do you guys do? Do you have a creative like way of doing primary debates? You know, I'm looking for creative solutions. And they were like, you know, we only have like a month for the whole campaign. So this is a non-issue, you know? So we are unusual in this respect. And I think it's certainly a reform that, that most Americans would welcome if there was a limit on campaigning.
Briefly, Amanda, for a change to debates, probably the politicians aren't going to make this happen. The media might not. Do you think that the public can demand a change?
It's a good question. I mean, we've got another debate coming up on November 20th. I suspect we'll see the ratings fall again. That's in Atlanta. And, you know, I just wonder, could some other organization come around and propose something radically different and much more compelling and convince the candidates to do it, you know? And then you could see, you kind of have to prove, you know, with any institution that's kind of coasting along, like TV news and politicians, you have to show them that it's possible to do something totally different and succeed. And then they will do it, right? But you're going to have to, I think, show them, because they're happy to just continue on with the legacy ways of doing things.
Thanks to Amanda for joining us. That's Amanda Ripley. You can share your thoughts on debates on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the State Department website recently featured on its homepage a picture of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivering a speech titled Being a Christian Leader. This caused some political watchers to wonder if he'd crossed a line between religion and government. We'll dig into that and related issues coming up. First, Governor Evers wants the state to have a plan for dealing with climate change. 2 weeks ago today, he signed an executive order creating a task force that will spend much of the next year developing a strategy to mitigate the effects of climate change. He called a warming planet, quote, a grave threat to the health, safety, and economic well-being of people and communities throughout Wisconsin. Evers named more than 30 people to the panel, including representatives of the industrial, agricultural, and higher education fields, and a few state lawmakers. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is leading that task force. In a few minutes, we'll talk with a Republican state lawmaker who's dubious about the plan. But first, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes talked to me earlier today. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
What is your vision for this task force?
My vision for this task force is to drive us into a clean energy future, simply put, to make sure that we're bringing ideas from individuals from so many different walks of life, but most importantly, impacted communities, people who've been fighting against climate change and working to develop solutions for clean energy here in Wisconsin. If you look at the task force, there's so many people from many different backgrounds, many different professions. That's the most exciting part about it. And we're trying to take a holistic approach to the way that we address the crisis here in Wisconsin.
Democrats and Republicans tend to have different views on the urgency of climate change, with Democrats in the governor's office and Republicans in the legislature. Do you have hope that whatever comes out of this task force has a chance of actually getting into legislation?
I think it should, because the urgency calls for it. There is not a debate about the urgency of the climate crisis. It's a very real thing. You know, it's snowing on Halloween here in Wisconsin. We've had a never-ending rainy season this year, seemingly, and it's affected our farming community in a very negative way. You look at the delay of crops, which has done a number on rural economies here across Wisconsin. So the urgency has never been more present, and I hope that, if we're talking about the legislature, I think that, we can specifically, I can think of one example who's spoken out about, acknowledging that climate change. The quote was climate change may be real, which was startling, but what was also stated was that, from the speaker, was that nobody knows how it got here or why we're at this place. But that can be further from the truth, and that's what the task force is going to be about. So I invite him to attend the task force meeting because he'll get to learn all about climate change, why it exists, and what we can do to stop it, and how Wisconsin can position itself as a national, if not global, leader.
Yeah, you're referencing Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in an interview with Wisconsin Eye. He said climate change is probably real, and he said if the task force focuses on things like increasing nuclear power and making sure you don't raise utility rates, he could get on board with their work. Do you see room for those two agenda items?
What we don't have room for is to narrow our focus from this task force. That's not the way to go about it. And, this isn't the Robin Voss way. I think he's getting a little too ahead of himself, thinking that his way is the only way for Wisconsin. That can be further from the truth. You look at last year's election results that prove that. And, like I said all the time, too, his speakership hinges on gerrymandering. So it's totally unfair for someone who got elected by 16,000 people in this state to decide the fate of our state and decide the direction of our state. That's not how a democracy works, and he should know a lot better.
In the press release on this task force, Governor Evers said that communities of color and low-income communities experience some of the first and worst consequences of climate change. How so?
Well, you look at communities across this across the country, coastal communities, people who don't necessarily have the means to avoid the impacts of climate change, and also other climate-related issues as well. And sometimes it's not always specifically climate change, but you look at the history of whether it's coal-burning power plants in low-income communities that disproportionately impact black and brown communities. You look at issues with water that primarily impact communities of color and lower-income communities. Those are climate-related issues, climate-adjacent issues that we have to get a hold on. And there's no dispute about the detrimental impact that so many people who haven't been able to overcome that impact have been feeling for generations.
Governor Evers signed an executive order over the summer aimed at eliminating Wisconsin's use of carbon-based fuel by 2050. Republicans said that's irresponsible. They don't think the technology is there. At this point, they worry about costs. How do you see getting there from here in the next, 31 years?
Honestly, this can go back to the same conversation that you said that the speaker had about nuclear energy. This goes back to money and politics. That's what this comes down to. You look at some of the donors in those various industries are the reason why we've been so stagnant, the reason why we haven't made the changes necessary to reduce our carbon emissions in the state. The political will isn't there because of the money that's involved in politics stifles that political will from our Republican counterparts.
Talking to Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes about a new task force on climate change here in Wisconsin. Former Governor Jim Doyle had created a global warming task force back in 2007. There were concerns at the time that, if you make these recommendations, we're going to lose jobs. There's going to be damage to the economy. Is that a potential risk of tackling climate change?
No, and I'm getting very tired of the fear mongering that they use. And I always use the example of my father and so many other people like him. After the EPA was created, we then had the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act meant that we had new emission standards for vehicles. Cars then had to have catalytic converters. My dad put together catalytic converters for 30 years. He was gainfully employed, as were so many other people. So if anything, this is an opportunity for us to advance our economy across the state because we've been missing out on so many opportunities. You look at clean energy jobs and the growth, how it outpaces job growth in any other sector. I want to say in 2017, the growth was about 17% in wind energy and about 25% in solar energy. And those are opportunities that Wisconsin needs to take a hold of. If anything, we're introducing the state to many more opportunities. There's no oil here in Wisconsin. We're sending $1 billion out of state, the average consumer, in terms of their spending on utilities. There's about $1 billion that goes out of state to produce energy that comes from fossil fuels. And we can do much better here in Wisconsin if we produce energy right here in our state.
Getting back to the task force itself, you touched on this briefly earlier. Can you talk about who is going to be at the table on this task force?
Yep, you got students, you got academics, you have a number of four legislators, you have a couple farmers, we even have utilities on the on this task force because you know we have to have them be a part of the conversation, and more importantly, than being a part of the conversation, we want them to be a part of the change. I'm trying to think of other business owners. The list goes on.
Now, President Trump had pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Governor Evers later joined a group of governors who are committed to still implementing those goals. Why do you see states stepping up here to take the lead now?
Because we have a responsibility. We are the United States of America, and we have a responsibility. And for, you know, the largest global superpower to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, which affirmed our commitment to making sure that we have a planet that's habitable for future generations, was disgusting and unfortunate. However, we do have governors who decided to step up to the plate and to live up and acknowledge that climate change is a real man-made threat, and we have to do everything we can do to face it. So I'm very proud of Governor Evers for having done that as one of his first acts in office, joining with other governors, because we're not going to let this administration get in our way or get in the way of progress.
What's the timeline for recommendations coming out of this new task force?
We are looking at fall of 2020 for the recommendations of the task force to be complete.
And I want to switch gears for our last couple minutes since we've got you on the line. Nothing to do with climate change. What do you think of state Democrats' newest push to decriminalize marijuana possession, applying to, I believe, 1 ounce or less?
I am fully supportive. As a person who was author of the bill, as a member of the assembly, I think this is an important first step. You know, if you look at our neighbors, you look at Illinois, who's going to be legal recreational marijuana beginning in January of next year, Minnesota, who has medical marijuana, and Michigan, who has legal recreational marijuana. I think that it's unfortunate that we're on an island of criminalization where people are still going to jail for marijuana possession. And, you know, even people who disagree with legalization, at the end of the day, they don't think that people should be in jail or serve a prison sentence for marijuana possession.
We'll leave it there. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Mandela Barnes, the Democratic Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. We talked to him about the state's new climate change task force. He is the head of that task force. Coming up, we'll hear from a Republican state lawmaker who's dubious of the new panel. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about Governor Evers' climate change task force. Its goal is to come up with ways for Wisconsin to mitigate the effects of a warming planet. It's supposed to send recommendations to Evers next August. The panel is led by Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. We heard from him a few minutes ago. Now, Representative Jim Ott joins us. He's a Republican state representative from Mequon, a former television meteorologist. Representative Ott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, what are your concerns about this task force?
Well, I guess my thoughts when I heard it was being formulated is that it sounds very similar to Governor Doyle's Global Warming Task Force, which came out with a 232-page report in 2008, just a little bit more than 11 years ago. And I'm just wondering what this task force is going to come up with that's different than what the Global Warming Task Force came up with, which include things like increased parking rates in cities, possibly lowering speed limits, enacting a far-reaching ethanol mandate, reducing the number of miles driven by individuals, telling farmers what to feed their cows, adopting California emission standards, and getting involved in a massive cap-and-trade scheme. So I don't know what this task force is going to come up with that's different from what the last task force came up with, which, in my opinion, at least, would have done nothing more had those recommendations been implemented into legislation, which I think is what was the goal of the task force. That never happened. But I think all those recommendations would have done, if they would have been followed, would have been to greatly increase the cost of energy in Wisconsin, and as well as everything that depends upon energy, And I really couldn't see any beneficial effect on the Earth's climate if we would have followed those as a state.
This new task force, as we just heard from the Lieutenant Governor, it includes environmentalists, but it also includes industry leaders, local governments, utility groups themselves. Do you think an organization like this with that mix of perspectives and lawmakers from both parties are supposed to be on it could come up with something that maybe both parties could agree on climate change?
Well, I certainly think if they came up with a recommendation to continue to support honest climate research, I certainly think that would be wonderful. If they had better ideas on how to conserve our natural resources, I would totally agree with that. If they would come out with ways to support a sensible energy policy, that might include things like going to more natural gas for electricity production, which is very plentiful right now. It's a clean fuel and it's relatively inexpensive. I think there's a lot of recommendations that they could come up with that would make sense and would get plenty of support. But I guess I'm just a little skeptical on what kind of recommendations they're going to come up with. Again, it's going to be the same sort of thing that is going to really push our energy prices through the roof. And the Lieutenant Governor was talking about the effects of climate change on poorer, lower, middle-income people. And the fact is, much higher electricity prices, gasoline prices, will have a disproportionate effect upon them than it will upon, you know, more well-to-do people.
One point that supporters of alternative energy have made lately is that, as compared to maybe when that Governor Doyle task force was around, things like solar and wind energy per unit costs have been going down over the years. Do you see that as a more viable alternative than it might have been, say, in 2008?
Well, I think when the price comes down to the fact that that the point where it would be competitive with traditional ways of producing electricity, I think that would be fine. But I think right now you still are having to put pretty large subsidies into solar and wind. You know, and then there's the aesthetic and health issues of, you know, too many windmills up on our landscape. If you talk to anyone who lives next to one of these windmills or close to them, they will tell you that there are some issues with them. And, you know, solar in a climate like Wisconsin is not necessarily something that'll work as well as it might in California or Arizona or New Mexico or an area that gets much more sunshine, both versus in terms of cloud cover and, you know, in time of the day that the sun is out. So I guess I would still look more to things like a sensible energy policy and maybe going to things that we know work. Now, again, if at some point we get to the point where solar and wind is competitive with other forms of producing electricity, I think it'll probably be happening more on its own without any sorts of mandates.
We are talking about a climate change task force established by Governor Evers. Jim Ott is with us, Republican state representative from Mequon. Your colleague, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, told Wisconsin Eye he thinks climate change is probably real. Do you agree with that assessment?
I'll tell you, as someone who's taught courses on meteorology and climatology at the university level, as well as working as a weather forecaster for many, many years, one of the things, and I think you'll find that any reputable meteorologist or climatologist will tell you that our climate has changed, that our climate is always changing, and that it will continue to change. And there are a lot of very many natural forcing factors that feed into climate change. And to be perfectly honest, we don't really understand exactly how all of them work. And the fact is, even if you believe in climate change, the big question that it comes down to all of us, is how much of that climate change is being influenced by human activity, specifically the production of fossil fuel, production of carbon dioxide from the use of fossil fuels, and how much of it is natural. And I guess my own point of view is, yeah, the climate's changing, but I haven't been convinced that fossil fuels are the driving force. Maybe the carbon dioxide does have an impact on our climate, but is that the driving force? I also think there's other man-made influences that can impact our climate, like changes in land use. You know, you go back a couple hundred years and the eastern two-thirds of the United States, eastern half of the United States was covered with forest land. Today, we've got more farm fields, we've got more cities and suburbs, we've got more roads, and the majority of the absorption of sunlight and the emitting of energy back to space comes at the surface of the Earth. And I think there have been profound changes at the surface of the Earth. And to the extent that that's impacting climate change, you won't have any, it wouldn't have anything to do with making our energy prices higher so that we put out less carbon dioxide. So, I mean, there's quite a debate in the scientific community. I don't know anybody, like I said, who disputes the fact that our climate can change, but the natural forces impacting our climate are pretty big, because these changes have been going on long before we were putting out carbon dioxide.
The big UN Committee on Climate Change, hundreds of scientists from around the world do say humans are a pretty big factor in this, including fossil fuels and concrete production and other forms of emissions. You don't buy that?
I don't say that. I realize there's a lot of different opinions mm-hmm. that come out of different experts. I don't think the consensus as overwhelming as it's sometimes put out. I know that there's been this figure of 97% of all climatologists and climate scientists, agree that the human influence is the main influence on our changing climate right now. But I think that's been pretty well debunked. I don't think it's 97%. I think it's a lower percentage. The other thing I would point out, Rob, is you look at some of the predictions that were made a relatively short time ago by the climate experts who are pushing the man-made global warming. I mean, we call the last one the Global Warming Task Force. This one's called the Climate Change Task Force. I guess the Global Warming Task Force was coming up with ways that we're going to make our climate not heat up as fast. I think the Climate Change Task Force is going to come up with ways now that's going to make our climate less variable. But I think they're going to come up with exactly the same recommendations. And I can just go back to about the time that the Global Warming Task Force was coming out with their report in 2008. The levels of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron were flirting with record lows. And the prediction by a number of the climate scientists, the same ones who are saying that human activity is the forcing factor in climate change, were predicting, based on their computer models, that the level of the Great Lakes were going to drop another 3 to 5 feet in the coming decades. Right now, Lake Michigan is lapping at the shoreline at a near record high. In fact, they might have even surpassed the record high on Lakes Michigan and Huron. It's exactly the opposite of what the prediction was just 10 or 11 years ago. And, I would say at the very least, I would think that this would give some of the people who are coming out with these very firm predictions on what's going to happen if we don't dramatically decrease our output of carbon dioxide, I think it would at least give them pause and go back and look at some of those computer models and say, maybe we don't have all the answers, and maybe we should find out some more definitive answers before we push energy prices through the roof and have a great negative impact on our economy. And even if fossil fuels are a big issue, and carbon dioxide is a big issue in the current climate change that we may or may not be experiencing, the fact is, you could have a natural effect that would either reinforce or actually negate that. So I think we got to have more answers before we trash our economy. And that's why I say I continue to support honest research. And I certainly think we should do everything we can to conserve our natural resources, have a sensible energy policy, and go forward and try to find out some answers. And I wish the Climate Change Task Force well. I certainly will look at the recommendations that they make. I do suspect we're going to see a lot of the same recommendations that we saw out of the old Global Warming Task Force.
Representative Ott, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
A pleasure to be with you, Rob. Take care.
That's Jim Ott, Republican State Representative from Mequon. We talked with him about Wisconsin's newly formed Climate Change Task Force led by Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. We talked to him just a few minutes ago. The task force will advise Governor Evers on a strategy to mitigate the effects of climate change here in the state. It's expected to make recommendations by August of next year. You can weigh in on what you've heard, what you want to see come out of this task force or not. Are there particular things you hope they will recommend? Particular things you hope they don't recommend, as Representative Ott was just saying there. You can weigh in on this on Twitter. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, email ideas@WPR.org. And of course, you can send us a message over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your hopes and fears when it comes to Wisconsin's new climate change task force. Looking for some scary entertainment on Halloween night? Look no further. Go online and check out some of these horror titles. Zombie Worlds, Reigns of Terror, Eternal Darkness, or how about Kepler's Inferno? No, they're not horror movies or pulp novels. They're some of the weirdest planets in the galaxy. And they're all featured on a special NASA webpage, Galaxy of Horrors. And you can download your own posters. For example, the zombie worlds I mentioned, quoting here, these doomed worlds were among the first and creepiest to be discovered as they orbit an undead star known as a pulsar. Pulsar planets like Poltergeist and its neighboring worlds Phobator and Draugr are consumed with constant radiation from the star's core. NASA says nothing but the undead can subsist in this most inhospitable corner of the galaxy. And I like this one, Eternal Darkness. There's a planet called TRES-2b. They call it the planet of eternal night, the darkest planet ever discovered orbiting a star. The alien world is less reflective than coal. Inside its atmosphere, NASA says you'd be flying blind in the dark. All right, pretty cool. We need to get a better color printer here at the Ideas Network. I don't think ours would do this justice. Download some of those posters. You could do it yourself, though. Explore more worlds. Find the NASA Galaxy of Horrors webpage, if you dare. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.